Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is sunny upstate Westchester, and it's 45 degrees. The sun is shining, and the weather is just perfect. And if the weather god would do me a favor and not bring the storm on Saturday, this girl would be absolutely grateful. But just remember this. I'm going to interview the author of Cold Blood, Kurt Camm, in about 2 minutes. 2 seconds, and this book is fantastic. And Mother's Day is on Sunday. Let me remind you that it's not too late to go to Amazon and order 10 copies of the book for everybody in your family. That's, you know, female, male, doesn't matter. Father's Day is coming up soon, too. That's my thing lately. And it's fantastic. And I also have to do this because if I didn't do it, I wouldn't be the best aunt in the world. Congratulations to my nephew, DJ. He's graduating from Stetson University on Saturday with a business degree. I am so proud. And, of course, he's following in my footsteps with a high GPA. So congratulations, DJ, and send your aunt some pictures. So Colt Lewis is a rookie fire paramedic, is obsessed with finding the severed foot of his first victim after she dies in his arms. That's scary. His search takes him into the connected lives of a graduate research student with the rarest blood in the world and the vampire fetish who is stalking her. I'm not going to tell you anymore. I'm going to let the author tell you. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm good.
I must say that it's a little warmer out here on the West Coast, and we don't have to pray to the weather gods because it's clear every day.
That's not fair. We have to pray every day that, you know, the last couple of the weeks it's been like on and off rain. So I said to my husband, I said, at least it's not snow. One of my neighbors said to me one day, you know, Brent, it's great. You know, you've been talking to the snow god and he hasn't come. I said, you see, you're not supposed to say that because the next day we had 20 inches. But the best part about living up here is that the sanitation department where I am is fantastic and the snow disappears the next day so you would never know it was there. Which is even better. So when you created this novel and deciding on the plot, what research and resources did you avail of in order to have accurate information about rescuing people and how a paramedic performs?
Well, first of all, I have written a series of firefighter mystery novels, and the Los Angeles County Fire Department adopted me after my first novel.
Nice.
And they had been terrific. And any time that I had a subject that I wanted to write about relating to fire activities, they were very accommodating. And in the case of paramedics, I spent several weeks actually riding with the paramedics. And it was quite an experience. Some of the things I saw were shocking. And it's interesting, at least here in Los Angeles, 85% of the calls that the fire department responds to are actually paramedic medical issues. And I had no idea that it was at that level. And every accident, every injury, the fire department responds. So I got to spend a lot of time with these guys, and I also attended some paramedic medical training. UCLA has a program for paramedics, and they were nice enough to let me attend some of the sessions. So that was part of my background. The other part of the background for the novel is, of course, all the scientific and medical research. And I have to tell you, since I've lived in Los Angeles, I've been involved, I guess it's been about 25 years, with the Cancer Center at UCLA. And eventually I became the chairman of the foundation. And for, I guess 15 or 20 years, I had the opportunity at least once a week to sit in on medical discussions and tour the laboratories and tour the facilities and talk to doctors and that sort of thing. And all of the background, which I'm sure we'll get into in our discussion today, all of the things that you read about at the, quote, university in my book, is really based on firsthand experiences at the UCLA Medical Center. So
that's
when you
fantastic.
Take that information and what I learned from the fire department, I was just dying to write a medical thriller, and that was Code Blood.
That was fantastic, and I have to tell you that maybe I should let my niece talk to you. My niece just passed EMT school.
Oh, great.
And,
great.
It's more than great. It's absolutely phenomenal. And she's thrilled, and she's going for firefighter paramedic starting next week. She goes to those classes.
I have incredible respect for the EMTs. They are, not only are they well-trained, but they have to be so resourceful because every incident is a little bit different. And it's more than going by the book. I mean, they have to improvise very often, and they tend never to lose their cool. They're great people.
Yes, she is. She's got the right temperament for it. And when she told me that she wanted to do it, of course, she made me buy the book so that I would be ready to work with her over the phone anytime she needed it. Anytime she needed it.
One of the sessions that I attended when they were doing the training, the EMT training, UCLA had I guess it was a full afternoon where the paramedic class was brought in and they did a dissection of a corpse. And it was a little disturbing, but it was incredibly fascinating. They started at the skull and literally worked through the entire body, taking out each organ. And the professor there, the doctor that was leading the group, was teaching these people about, you know, what to expect, what to see, what the different organs looked like. And I stayed for 2.5 hours and then I had to leave. What I learned was I thought, well, where did they get this body? I mean, it was a real human body, and apparently, I thought to myself, who would donate his or her body to be dissected like that? But there are actually people who die who say, yes, I will give my body to medical training and research, knowing that their body would be used for a dissection. So it was quite something. And the body had been preserved for, I guess, 24 hours. And if I'm getting a little too vivid here, just cut me off.
That's
but
okay.
I'm
not squeamish. I don't get squeamish. That's okay.
It's always stuck in my mind. They began by taking a little saw and cutting off the top of the head so that they could look at the brain. And the one part of the body that doesn't get preserved when they do this preservation for 24 hours is the brain. So the brain had begun to really disintegrate. So the doctor said, you know what? He said, we've got to get another brain for you to look at. And there were all these assistants standing around. He said, can we get another brain in here? And one of them runs out of the room, and about 5 minutes later comes in with a metal bowl with a brain in it. And
oh, God.
I thought, my God, what am I going to see next? So,
I know that in college I did dissect a cow's brain in a deer's eye. It didn't bother me. I don't know about a real person's brain, though.
Well, the brain itself actually was less surprising than going through the rest of the organs. Some of the other things that I touch on in the book too are all real life. UCLA has what they call a vivarium, and a vivarium is where they breed mice. And there's that scary scene where Marcus is chasing the Chinese girl down underground and into the vivarium, and that was a real place. They breed genetically altered mice that are used for research, medical research, drug research, and it's underground because there's a certain number of protests and things about what they do with mice. So it's not visible above ground. And when I went down to see it, I had to sign a waiver saying that I would never disclose where it was or how I got there. And then they took me through this series of underground tunnels, which is also related in the book, into this place where it was just all white tile. It was absolutely immaculate. And thousands of mice that belonged to different researchers and were being bred with different genetic alterations. They call them knockout mice because they knock out certain genes in the mouse in order to test drugs and that sort of thing. So there was that, and then there's another scene where they're in this nano research building, and again, that actually exists. And the Nano Science Center deals with nanoparticles, which are some of them are as tiny as 1/20th of the width of a hair. So when you go into this nano building, they tell you that it is built on it's built on shock absorbers. Obviously, you've heard about buildings that have shock absorbers for earthquakes. Mm-hmm. But this has to be so sensitive. I remember the man telling me that if there was a trash truck rumbling down the street six blocks away, it could disturb some of the, you know, research that they're doing in the building. So it had these incredible devices to cushion it so that there could be absolutely no vibration. So there were things like that, and each of these different events I use in the book, all the research in the laboratories and that sort of thing. And I guess the spookiest thing was that there are actually underground tunnels at UCLA, and they were actually built 40 or 50 years ago, and most of them are sealed off. They still use a few of them to access air conditioning and to get to some underground facilities like the mice and that sort of thing. But most of these tunnels are sealed off, and I had a great time imagining my different characters going through these tunnels and, you know, what they see and that sort of thing. So I must say, this was a book. One of the great things about being an author is the experiences you have. And if you're lucky enough and skillful enough to incorporate the excitement and the experiences that you actually have into the novel, then you've got a good novel. And I must say that when I was writing Code Blood, I had some incredible experiences. Absolutely incredible, and I will always remember all the things that I got to do.
Well, wait till you read my review, and you're going to really know what I thought, which is
really great.
Because I read the blurb, and I don't get a lot from the press release or anything, or the synopsis, and then they sent me the book, and I'm just sitting down. I'm going, okay, it's going to take me a while to read this. No, it's not. And I said, okay, this one doesn't have font, one font. And then I'm sitting down, and I started to read it, and then I'm getting like, I could picture. I just found the page in my book. Books are always in front of me. I don't give anything away until afterwards, and then there's 20 people that want to read everything I read. Page 170, where the doctor said to provide a realistic dissection, the body remains in its natural state. It's been refrigerated but not embalmed. And I'm looking there reading this, and I can imagine all the students passing out, first-year medical students getting, oh, my God. And I could actually, most of the scenes that you wrote were so graphically depicted that I could actually feel like I was there.
Well,
and
Fran, the
I
other
don't get
thing
squeamish.
I have to tell you, I forgot this. This was my trip through the L.A. County morgue. And they have some tours, but you don't get to see much. And I wanted to really get a good view. And I called up the morgue, and incredibly enough, the top guy answered the phone. I called first thing in the morning. I don't know why he did, but I told him who I was. And he said, well, all right, if you want to come down, and gave me a date. He said, I'll take you through it. So I went down there, and I spent about 3 hours going through the morgue. And I must tell you, again, that was an experience I will never forget. In the bottom, in the basement, they do something like 10 or 12,000 autopsies a year. Now, if you think that there are 365 days in a year, think about how many bodies they are cutting up and investigating. And it's nothing like, the morgue is nothing like what you see on CSI crime scene, where you walk into this spick and span place with one stainless steel table and everything is clean and that sort of thing. They had a room that had, I think it had 12 or 15 tables where they worked on bodies. And the floors were tile, and overhead were these pull down hoses where, you know, after they would pull them down and turn them on and wash all the blood and everything off onto the floor and into the drains. And as we walked in, there were several bodies on carts waiting to be wheeled into the dissection room. And, of course, they were all naked. And I'll never forget, he said to me, he said, you know, and this is a right in the book, word for word, he said, there's no modesty down here. He said, these are all deceased people, and, you know, they were lying totally naked on these carts. And then we proceeded to a place which now has been changed, I understand, but it was the freezer room. And he opened this this door that was, it was one of these huge, probably 12-foot-high rolling doors, and inside was a freezer with bodies. And they were stacked one on top of another. They were wrapped in plastic. And that was, as I say, that I understand has since been changed. But it was just shocking because you walk out of the morgue and all the things that you thought about sort of the sanctity of the human body and that sort of thing are totally washed away, totally overcome by just the numbers and the magnitude of what's going on there. And I don't say this in a critical way. I mean, their job is to find out why a person died and try to identify them and find the next of kin and that sort of thing. And they're very professional and that sort of thing. But, what a sight. So, when the readers get to that part of the book, if it seems real, that's because it is.
That's what I thought after reading that whole thing, and I'm going to have to warn my niece about this. She might have to actually do it. I think she can.
Maybe you ought to wait till she's already a paramedic and not discourage her.
I'll tell you, Casey, just don't worry about it. She actually jumped out of a plane the other day too. I was like,
wow, great,
really?
Good for her.
Yeah, she did.
I couldn't do that.
No, neither could her aunt do it. I could do a lot of things, but that's not one of them. But when creating cult, I like this guy. He's new to the profession, so he became sensitive. He reacts to death with passion, and he doesn't really listen to his partner's warning about coming too close to the victim, which is not good. So why did you create him that way? And the way you created this novel with a missing foot, I mean, that's amazing. So how come you created him with actually like that?
Again, I have to tell you, by way of background, that when first I decided I wanted to write a paramedic story, and I went to the 88, which is Station 88 here in Malibu, L.A. County, and introduced myself to the paramedics and everything, and we were chatting. The firefighters love to talk. I mean, they have stories. When they're not working, they're telling stories. And every one of them's got 10 stories about an event, an incident that he had went to that this or that happened. So one of the paramedics told me this story about responding on Pacific Coast Highway to an accident where a woman's foot had been severed. And they couldn't, for the first 5 or 7 minutes, they were searching for her foot and they couldn't find it. And ultimately they found it under the truck that had hit her. And I heard this story and I thought, wow, that would be a great plot for a novel. And I was, you know, I've got a good imagination, and I'm thinking, okay, let's say that this happens and the woman's foot is severed, and let's say there's some weird guy who walks by and picks up the foot and takes it with him. Everybody's standing around saying, where's the foot, where's the foot? And that was the sort of the beginning of my story. And I guess I've got a great imagination, because once I have that sort of framework, I don't really outline my stories. I just sort of let them flow. And I keep imagining, well, if the paramedics are there and they can't find the foot, what are they thinking and what are they doing and what are they saying? And I found that these paramedics, I mean, they're firefighters. They're strong men. They most of them go through firefighting before they become paramedics. So they're doing manly stuff, but they're still sensitive. And many of these guys are understandably really disturbed to lose someone, to lose someone they're trying to save. And in paramedic parlance, your niece will learn this if she hasn't already, they speak of the golden hour. And what that is generally the 1 hour after they attend a critically injured person. And that's the hour during which the person will either be saved or lost. And so they're always speaking of the golden hour. And when they lose somebody, they really feel it. It's quite interesting. And Colt, my young paramedic, I modeled him after one of the guys. There was a squad of four paramedics that I rode with, and this one guy, he was slightly smaller than the rest of them. You know, firefighters are generally big guys. He was a little bit smaller and a little bit younger, and he was just, I thought, more sensitive than any of the others. And he gave me the idea of my firefighter Colt, who is struggling to come to terms with the things he sees as a paramedic.
That's amazing, because you could feel his emotion. So when they try to rescue the girl that was hit by the truck, they realize her foot was missing. So he had this thing, he wanted to find it because he wanted her to be buried with the foot. So when they questioned the witnesses, nobody came forward at all. And that's where paramedics do care, trust me. I was in a car accident in August, and I couldn't believe they went that double extra mile for this person. So I really know that's true.
Yep.
And the only thing I wouldn't answer is how old I am, and I told them I couldn't remember. They looked at me going, don't even ask that question, Because by the time he asked me all my questions, he said, doesn't matter. He says, you're sharper than most people. I go, just remember that. Can I tell you?
I love it.
I have a sense of humor, but yeah. As a matter of fact, when I go to the doctor's office and they go, what's your date of birth? They said, look it up under Fran Lewis, and you'll figure out my date of birth. I won't even answer them, especially when they ask you that in front of 1,000 people. And
well,
like,
you know, speaking of
that,
I'm not exactly a youngster myself, and over the years, I did so many things with the L.A. County Fire Department, and they always make you sign a waiver, you know, before you do a ride-along or whatever. And frankly, they let me do things that I probably shouldn't have been doing, and I never told them how old I was because I always thought that if they knew how old I was, I wouldn't even be on the engine. I can sympathize with you on the age issue.
Well, I'm not that old. It's just that it's a question that I never answer. And my answer to them was older than some and younger than most. And they couldn't even come up with a comeback for that one. I go,
great.
Like, yeah, I told you I'm very smart. What can I tell you?
I love it. Well,
Marcus
speaking
Draper,
of Colts. Colt's his reaction to losing the girl, as the reader gets partway into the book, then they realize what else is going on in Colt's background and his missing mother and how all that sort of plays into his feelings about finding out who this girl is I had fun with having him imagine what her background was. And, of course, he imagines her living here in Malibu. There are all kinds of movie celebrities. And there's two groups of people in Malibu, the ordinary people like me, and then the incredibly wealthy and famous people that live in $20 and $30 million houses on the beaches. And there's always this image that everybody in Malibu is an important person living in a beautiful house and that sort of thing. And I kind of used that for Colt's imagination of who this girl was and what she was doing, which, of course, turns out to be totally false.
Well, doesn't matter. This is like... So it was just so amazing just to read this. So my next question is, Marcus Draper, the albino, that was good. And why did you create him in this way? And what made him turn goth? I love goth. I'm so interested in drinking blood, which now, when after I read that, I could not drink any cranberry juice. I just want you to know that I had to put a moratorium on cranberry juice.
Well, first of all, again, I'll tell you that one of my friends, doctors that I came to know at the UCLA Medical Center was the head of hematology oncology. He was an expert in blood for cancer purposes, and he was the one who told me about Bombay blood and how rare it is. And this was, again, I sort of collected a bunch of ideas, and I thought, how great is that? This blood, Bombay blood has no antigens in it, so it can be used as a transfusion for a person with any other blood type. On the other hand, if you have Bombay blood, and it's very rare and only people from a certain part of the world have it, if you have that blood, you must have that as a transfusion. Any other blood type will cause a reaction in your body and kill you. So I began to imagine, I thought, well, great, this is this rare blood. Let's create a person who's obsessed with it, who finds out about it and is obsessed with it. And again, I have a friend here in Los Angeles, a woman, her name is Justice Howard, and that's her real first name, Justice. Justice is a world famous photographer of women with tattoos. And mm-hmm. Justice is a goth person, and her pictures of semi-naked women with tattoos all over their bodies are seen everywhere in the world. And Justice and I had had a lot of conversations, and I'd always imagined, I was always sort of fascinated with these people that are interested in being goth. And I put that together with someone who would be interested in blood, and I ended up with Marcus. And with all my characters, I always try to find out what weird thing, or not weird, but what is their background? What is the emotional thing from their childhood which drives them as an adult? And I mean, obviously, I think all of us are formed by our childhood. So here's Marcus, this kid who, because he's an albino, underwent all kinds of medical attention and tests and everything as a child. And what better background to create, you know, some crazy adult who's interested in blood and turns out to be goth and that sort of thing. And as I thought about it,
different.
Yeah, you know, taking it to the extreme, here he is thinking, well, if he can get this blood, then is that me that's beeping? He's thinking he could sell this blood and spread it around, give it to his goth friends, and make a bunch of money in the process. So that's Marcus. And I think Marcus is probably, of all the novels I've written, probably, I wouldn't say he's my favorite character, but he's certainly my most complex. And
you're going to have to bring these people back, I'm telling you, really, seriously. Yeah, because that's what I
think. Marcus
said, oh my God,
is probably deceased. I think he was living a screwed up life that I doubt if he's alive at this point.
Well, let's talk about the person whose blood he drank. That was Audra.
You know what? I think the battery on my phone is going down. Can I call you back on another phone? But it's beeping. I'm going to call you in 2 seconds.
Leave that on and then call me back so the line doesn't disconnect. Well, the show will disconnect and I'll be disconnected.
All right, hold on. I'll call you right back. I'll leave this on.
Okay. Okay, so for those of you that are listening, let me tell you that Monday we have the author of I Love You Today, and you want to see that. On Wednesday, I'm going to be talking about gangs and gang warfare in the United States with 3 law enforcement officers. That'll be fantastic. On the 22nd, I've got the author of Crossing the Street. And on the 24th, one of my favorite people, Alan Topol, the Washington Power Play. And on the 24th, we've got Big City Heat by David Burnsworth. And on June 1st, we have Genocide. And that's going to really be fantastic, too. Coming up in June 20th, A Fine Imitation and Practicing Normally. Hold on a minute. I'm going to let the author back in on another phone. Okay. Are you there? I got you.
Yep, I'm here. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. I just announced my lineup for next week and the week after, so that's okay.
How many podcasts do you do once a week?
It depends. depends on whether they hook me to do them or whatever. What happened was yours was today, and they knew that. But somehow another person's got today too. So I had to put it. So usually I do 2, and this week 3, which is unusual. And next week 2, and then the week after I'm doing 3. And the week after that, hopefully 1. And then one or two more in June, and then who knows? You never know. Because when Cheryl's listening, by the way, hi Cheryl, she's listening from Partners in Crime. She said this is coming through great, and they listen, and I know that they're gonna get me for a few more because I have one for August 1st from them, and one for August 23rd. It's like wow. So it depends.
Fran, how many books do you think you? How many books do you read every year?
Every year? Are you sitting down?
Yeah.
Over a thousand, sometimes more.
Wow.
Well, I have to blame it on the two people, my mother. My mother, Ruthie. My mother taught me that you have to go to school, go to Hebrew lessons, go to violin, go to piano, and the only thing I hated, till this day, Klutz, and I'm little, dancing lessons. I couldn't do it no matter what. I found out later on when I got older as the reason why I was having trouble, so I didn't care about that. She made me read 10 books every week. And
wow.
So there was none of the
excuse.
Isn't that
terrific?
20,000 hours. Yeah, 20,000 hours of homework, it didn't matter. But I was the only person in the library where you could take out a certain amount of books, whatever. They let me take out anything I wanted. And I would read, and I would take notes. And she would say, you have to do a book report eventually. And go, Mom, these teachers don't give me that many. Yeah. So I read a book a night, maybe. That's depending on my homework. And depending on if she said lights out, and I would finish the book under the covers with a flashlight. And my sister would do the same thing, seriously. And I took notes on an index card, and I underlined. So now when I read a book, like yours too, I underline in the book, I circle, and I write down what I want to remember that in order to use it to help me write the review. And then I realized you don't need that because I have it all in my head just by taking notes. So, yeah, it's her fault. That and my third grade teacher, Natalie Roberts, who I have to thank for making me read the classics when I was eight, the originals.
Well, that's great. One of the things that worries me about our future generation is people don't seem to read. And,
you're right. They don't. They don't.
Or they're reading in 140 characters at a time, and I don't know. That worries me.
I
but
agree.
I guess that's somebody else's problem.
Well, I'm a reading and writing staff developer. I was taught kids with remedial reading. That was what I did before I retired. So I'm a licensed reading person and writing person. So my nephews, you know, get a lot of articles to read on biology. Last week it was the First Amendment. You never know what they're going to have to do a term paper on. And they email me, can you get me some links? Can you help me put my ideas together? So obviously all this past training does help because I don't write the paper, but I will help them organize because that's fun. And last week actually it was an article on the First Amendment that actually helped me do my interview with Brian Freeman because the book was based on that, so I learned a lot more than I knew even before. So, yeah. Mm. My kids don't read today, and they don't realize. Well, I have my little 9-year-old niece, Penelope, reads a lot. She's my book partner, so her birthday was last weekend. For her birthday on Sunday, I bought her a bag of books, and she was thrilled. I think it was
great.
About 50 of them
great.
In there. Yeah. So, why was Audra, I feel so bad for her. She let him drink her blood, so why was she sad? And she was a flawed character. So why did she allow him to do this? I mean, really. And he was even when she said no, he said yes to her.
She was really an abused child. You know, she has. And again, Justice Howard provided me with a picture of a woman that had a full body tattoo. And had explained to me this woman, this tattoo had taken 3 years and cost $25,000 or $30,000. So again, in my imagination, Audra, whose father sexually abused her, had this tattoo done to, in her mind, to cover up the places that he had touched her body, and she was a person who was really, how do I say it, used to being abused, okay, to the point where she expected it. So when Marcus did the things he did to her, this was just a continuation of the kind of life she had.
Oh my
and
God.
I had asked. I had actually expected Audra to be a main character who would go through the entire book, but she didn't make it. She got killed off early in the book, and I liked her. I felt sorry for her, but she just didn't make it.
I was hoping she would, so that she could drink his blood and soak him dry. No, seriously. That's just my warp sense of humor for today. Okay, so we've got Colt. Tell us why. He didn't give up on finding this foot, and he was obsessed. So how did he go about deciding who stole this foot? And yet in his heart, you know, he might have figured out who stole the foot.
Well, you know, it's really it. I think life is determined a lot mm-hmm. by coincidences, and mm-hmm. Marcus, who dresses completely in black, there's this initial scene at the accident, and Colt is bent over the girl, and here's Marcus walking out of this beach restaurant on Pacific Coast Highway in the bright, beautiful, sunny California beach day, and he's dressed totally in black. And Colt looks up and notices him. I mean, there are people standing around and everything, but happens to notice, he notices Audra, who is gorgeous, and notices this guy, Marcus, who's totally dressed in black. So if we move further on into the book, Colt, and again, I have done this, the paramedics are delivering someone to the UCLA emergency ward. Colt is there, and later on, he's just wandering around the campus at UCLA, and he sees Marcus, and he recognizes him, not because of his face or anything, but again, he's dressed totally in black, and starts following him. And that's really sort of the beginning of Colt's obsession with Marcus. And it's totally by accident. I mean, he didn't do a police search or anything else. He just ran into him again on the UCLA campus. So that's how that happens.
So Colt has a past relationship with his father. And he thought that his mother left and never contacted
yep.
him. Even once that part really got me, because that I've heard other people say that in real life too. So
mm-hmm.
what happens when he learns the truth? That really got me, because that's sad.
Again, it's true. There are so many stories about children whose parents have deserted them or think their parents have deserted them, only to mm-hmm. learn later in life. And I actually have a nephew. My sister deserted my nephew. I sort of know that firsthand. And in Colt, his mother disappears. And he believes that she has run off, you know, with another man, and that's the idea he gets from his father. His father doesn't really know whatever happened to his mother, or doesn't tell Colt. And Colt, you know, a little kid, tends to take on the guilt. I did something wrong. I did something bad, and my mother left me. So that's the kind of adult you become. You feel guilty and you feel unworthy and that sort of thing. And ultimately, when his father dies in Wyoming and Colt goes through all the papers and everything, he finds this letter from the Texas, I think they call it the Department of Safety or whatever, and it's a letter indicating that his mother died in a car crash. And they're sending their condolences and asking about details, what they want to do about the body. And Colt learns for the first time as an adult that his mother, who had promised to come back to him and had promised never to forget him and all these sorts of things, that really what happened to her was she was killed in an automobile crash. And that makes him feel better, but it's almost too late because he's already a fully formed adult who has this guilt and this sense of loss, which even though he finds out what really happened to his mother, he still screwed up. And he translates this sense of loss and this guilt into finding what happened to this girl. I mean, it's more than looking for her foot. He wants to identify her. He wants to he's sure that there are parents or somebody who need to know who she is because she remains unidentified at the morgue. So that's his motivation.
Now, when dealing with
and
the
of
death
course,
of Bibi, or as we know her as Darcy, why does he create a false pass for her?
He imagines, this is, you know, again, as I say, this is what people, if you came to Malibu and you saw someone sitting in at Starbucks, you'd say, well, gee, what's that person's background? I'll bet she lives here in Malibu and she has a luxurious life and does important things and has a lot of money and that sort of thing. And when he sees her lying there bleeding out, he immediately starts to think about this girl who lives in Malibu and as I say, has this wonderful life, and she's engaged to a fighter pilot and all this. And, of course, when he finds out who she really is and what her background is, of course, it's a great shock. And as the reader, you say, well, of course, obviously, you know, he was imagining, you know, one person, and then he finds she's a totally different person. So, you know, that, again, That's typical human nature, I think.
Let me have a few more
and
questions.
How did you like her parents?
I
mean, when you found out what her real background was, I hope that you sort of said, oh, gosh.
Well, we have a few more questions on this second page. I get carried away sometimes. Dr. Murray is the head researcher in the Nano Research Lab. I always find that so interesting. And he's in charge of the research team and her project. Why is she so critical of her, and what happens when she learns that father is ill and he has just to return home?
Well,
and
again,
that was Ali.
Ali. One of my closest friends at the UCLA Medical School is the head of what they call basic research. And many of these scenes are taken from his classrooms and his seminars and that sort of thing. And when he read the book, his name's Harvey Hirschman, not Dr. Murray. Harvey, who's a wonderful guy and a close friend, was really disturbed. He said, why did you make Dr. Murray such a bad guy? And I said, well, Harvey, I said, if I had made him as nice a person as you are, no one would have cared. I had to create some tension. And it's true, most of the what they call the postdoc researchers, that means postdoctoral, are many of them are Asians. UCLA has a large population of brilliant Asian students. Many of the researchers in the medical school are Chinese and from other foreign countries. And they all, at the beginning, have a language problem. So here's Ali, again, you know, going back to her childhood, suffering from things that happened to her in childhood. She doesn't come from the mainstream Communist Party elite in China, which gets to attend the best universities. She's of Tibetan descent, which was necessary in order for her to have the magic blood. And she's suffering from an inferiority complex, and she's unhappy in Los Angeles, as many of these people are at first, because it's an incredible culture shock. And she's having difficulties with the language, and taking her instructor, Dr. Murray, and making him a slightly mean and critical of her just created that tension and that difficulty for her. And of course, she's a traditional, you know, Chinese person who family is very, very important. And her father, you know, gave up everything to get her to a higher education. So when she learns that he's ill, it's devastating to her.
Yeah,
so that's her motivation. Yeah. And I have a friend from, again, that I met at UCLA, a Chinese man, and his wife is a researcher. So they helped me sort of imagine what Ali's life would be like. And they were the ones who sort of helped me fill in her background from China.
Well, let me ask the next few questions before we have about 8 minutes, and I've got about 8 questions. What can I tell you?
Okay,
so,
I'll be short.
Marcus, tell us about Marcus and why he collects body parts. That's so gross. And what does he do with them? And, yeah, I was like, okay, today I'm going to sell your liver, and tomorrow I'm going to sell your elbow. And I thought, well, you know, I don't get paid to do this, so that might be interesting field to not go into. And who are Alexa and Grisha, and why do they take out their payment directly on Marcus?
Well, creating these Russians who deal in body parts was so much fun.
So cool.
And that was one thing which nobody helped me with. It was all out of my imagination. And to imagine these Russians speaking this broken English and dealing in body parts, I laughed about that. And when my friends at UCLA Medical School read that, the book, their favorite part was the Russian body part dealers. And Marcus had to have a body part fetish or he would have never picked up the foot. So, you know, I had to create this thing, but it sort of fit. I mean, here's this weird guy. He's obsessed with blood. He's a real low life. And as a child, you know, he collected severed paws and parts of animals and that sort of thing. So as he grows into an adult, what would he graduate to? He would graduate to human body parts. And the paramedics always got a big kick out of that. They were always kidding me about, you know, what body part was I looking for? And that sort of thing. So Marcus, you know, Marcus is Marcus. He's a low life, and he gets involved with these Russians. And the scene in the embalming basement in this funeral parlor, I laughed so much when I wrote it, and every time I reread it, I continue to laugh. So
Grisha was
Grisha was the Russian enforcer, the one who was after Marcus.
Well, too bad Marcus is gone, because we can bring her back and get more people. So this was interesting about DNA and Bombay blood. So if Ali's research work, would that really help anybody? Would that really be helpful?
It might. Actually, there was some, you know, this was, again, a little bit of a stretch. I had some scientific background from the professors there and everything, and it was possible. That's not really the genetic research that they're doing is not in that direction, but there was at least a bit of a scientific basis for it. Certainly for the reader, there was more science there than any reader would get beyond.
Yeah, I think so, but you know what? I enjoyed reading that part, although I just received, and I won't say the name of the book, a book that has so much science in it that somehow the murder got lost somewhere.
And well, you can't do that.
If it takes me more than 2 hours to read a book, you're in trouble. It depends. If a book is like a small print, which I hate, and it takes me a long time to read it, if I think it's worth it, I'm going to take my time reading it. Your book I read twice because I wanted to make sure that I got it, which, of course, I wasn't worried. But it's when the murder loses something in it and there's too much science in it. They go, oh, my God. I'm not going to ask how you learned how to dissect a mouse because I had to dissect a frog in high school.
I watched it.
I couldn't do it.
In the lab.
I couldn't do it. I was lucky I was adorable back then. And my lab partner in college, I looked at him and I said, I'm not doing this. I cannot kill Elmer. I named the frog. And after that, the professor looked at me. I said, I don't care if you give me an F. I cannot kill anything. Well, maybe a bug that's going to bite me. I cannot kill anything. And I felt so bad for the poor frog. And my nephew, when he was two, until he was 10, used to make me go into the woods and get frogs for him. So, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my God. I got skunked doing that. So, finally, what happens at Marcus meets Colt and blows him off? And how does Colt use his position to find out who Nate is and why does he help him at the end?
Say again, Colt uses position.
Well, what
to
happens
when
Marcus meets Colt, right, and blows him off?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to know from him. So how does Colt use his position to find out information, and who is Nate, and why does he help him?
Yeah, Colt, again, this is pretty much reality. Colt is a firefighter. Mm-hmm. So UCLA, every university has its own fire department. So Colt contacts the UCLA fire department and he gets information, and he goes to the nanoscience center and he says he's an arson investigator, which he's not, but I wrote a book about arson investigators, so I use a little bit of that. And he is able, by hook and crook, to find out who Marcus is and where he works and what he's doing. So, and he says he's doing an arson investigation, and that's how that plays out. And of course, the scenes in the underground tunnels are all a result of Colt going to the UCLA fire department and getting maps of the tunnels. Mm-hmm. To find out what's under there. And the actuality is that there are maps of these tunnels, but as I said, they're all closed off.
I would love to do something like that. That sounds so exciting, though. So,
well, come out to Los Angeles.
About,
I'll take you to the morgue.
I don't know if I, the only thing I know I couldn't do is I would have to have a case of Vicks. I know that. And I know you need a case of Vicks to put on your nose. Yeah, I know that.
If you give me advance notice, Fran, I'll get you a body part.
All I know is that my mother was in UCSD, the University of San Diego in California, where she had a pulmonary thrombectomy. Yes, that's a good one. It was a 24-hour operation. It took us 16 and a half hours to get there by plane because the plane almost crashed a couple of times. And I said a lot of prayers to every God in America. And it was a Learjet that we paid $12,900 for because they said we need to have a paramedic, blah, blah, blah. This paramedic needed to go back to school, and he was horrible. And by the time we got there, I really didn't think we were going to get there. And I kissed the ground, and we were in Los Angeles, and then we went to San Diego. And it was interesting because you learn a lot about the medical profession. The operation really taught me a lot, too, because actually they let me in the theater to watch. Scary. And then when they asked me to come there to see her, they have a very different kind of different. I don't know if they have it where you are in UCLA, but they have a special area where they have people, and it could be like 10 people in a room or four. It doesn't matter. Men, women, doesn't matter. They don't care. And they give you a job to do when you get there. They taught me how to use the machines and how to read them and how to help the guy that was, they knew he wasn't going to make it, to talk to him in the next bed because he was comatose, and they put me to work. So
wow.
I found
wow.
it, you know, yeah, I was like, I came here to visit my mother, and she couldn't wake up, so they had me talking to the other patients. And you know what? That was a great experience because it took my mind off of the fact that I didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a story about personal secrets, demons, fears, rejection. How does this apply to Colt, Marcus, and Ali? And are you bringing him back? Because you have to. Seriously.
I'm probably not bringing any of them back. I tend to move on. You've got my book about South American drug dealers, and you'll
see
totally,
trust me, I'm going to read that.
Totally new group of characters. Again, all these people, I would just say again, everybody as an adult is formed by their childhood experiences, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
Traumatic or happy, you know, you're a combination of all the sad and happy and things that happened to you as a child. And much as you think as an adult that you are, you know, you can direct your life and be whatever you want and that sort of thing, underneath, I think everybody is self-determined to a large extent by what happened to them in childhood.
I agree with
you
because at 3 years old,
I'll
my mother and my aunt told me I was going to be, she told me I was going to be an educator at 3 years old. I think they indoctrinated it in me. You will follow in your aunt's footsteps. You will be a reading specialist. I think every day of my life since the day I was born. And when I went to college, I graduated college at 18. And I said, I guess I'm an educator at 18. My aunt was an educator at 16. And she was a genius. And I said to her, my mother looked at me when I went to school. It took a while to get my bearings. I had the worst class in the sixth grade, but they learned who was in charge, and it wasn't them after a while. And she said, do you ever sorry that you did that? I said, no, it's the best thing I ever did. So, yeah, sometimes you're formed by your childhood experiences, or sometimes you're formed because Ruthie said you're going to do it. And she was a perfectionist.
Well, that's a childhood experience, sure. Fran, give me your email address.
All right. Yeah, she was. My mother was tough. But you know what? That was okay. So you're not going to bring back Colt. I thought you had a Colt Lewis series. I thought this was going to be a series of, you know, different things because you could do so much with him.
Now, each book is different. New characters.
So what's
what
next?
I want to do is,
what am I getting next?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. The drug dealer thing is the last thing I worked on. And again, you'll find that all the characters are really motivated by what happened to them as, you know, in their younger years, except some of the really bad people. The bad people are just bad in this case.
Okay,
I want to
so
get
before
your
we
email.
End,
yeah. I want to get your
wanna
email
get my email address.
Yeah. If you don't want to give it over the phone. Okay.
You know what? I can do. I can give it to. I'll tell Cheryl to give it to you. Cheryl, you listening?
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
there. I'm going to tell Cheryl to give it because I have. We the
sure.
reason why I make the show private is because the show is being monitored and recorded by Blog Talk Radio, and they do monitor the comments that come after. And that was because about a month ago, and that was the very first time. But from what I understood from Blog Talk, a lot of people are getting ridiculous people on their shows, you know, saying stupid things and ridiculous things that make absolutely no point whatsoever, and I just didn't like the fact that I was talking to a guy that was working with the Ivory Coast and why you should not kill elephants for their tusks and drug money and stuff like that. The book was fantastic. A Tome for the Ivory Coast was by Jeffrey Well. It was absolutely fantastic book, and obviously they didn't like the topic. So I did say on the air, if you don't like my show or my style and you don't like the topic, why don't you just disconnect? And they did, and I reported it to Blog Talk Radio. Yeah.
Okay,
and,
Cheryl can give me your email address, and I'll be in touch with you.
Yeah, and that would be great. And I'm going to read the book, I promise. It's just that there's like 20,000 people. You know what it is? When I sign up for a blog tour, they want the book on a certain day. Oh, well.
Okay.
So, Cheryl, I'm still waiting for June 1st and something else that you just hooked me for July 7th. Okay, so where can everybody find out about you more and you and your work?
I've got a website, kcam.com, and or they can Google me on Amazon and get to my website.
I can do that too. So thank you very much. I'm emailing her right now.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
It was great talking to you. And do us a favor, please. Saturday, we're expecting a rainstorm. Would you send me some sun and no rain?
I will do that.
Okay, everybody. I will be back on Monday, with the author of I Love You Today. And thank you, Kurt. And I hope to be in touch and do another interview. Everybody, thank you.
Thanks,
and
Fran.
Bye.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, Lucy.